if it's presented to them on a high street, some people who maybe didn't even know that there was such a thing as hand-painted signs might say, hold on, I've got a cafe, why don't I do that?
Luring customers into your shop in the age of the hobbled high street takes more than a whiz website or a savvy social media campaign. Sometimes a little swish signage can go a long way. We'll take an in-depth look at the bright future of traditional sign writing and ask why the craft is seeing such a resurgence. Today, right here on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also ahead,
the design approach is very much based around display, concessions, the sort of changing nature and the process of craft and making, which, you know, it always has been. So it almost feels like you're walking around different parts of our organisation.
We'll take a tour of an old department store that's been respectfully revived as an enviable HQ by architecture firm Squire. Plus,
you can almost get lost in it, and what are you going to do next? I mean, it'd be nice to see porcelain and cork or ceramics and cork. That would be beautiful.
If you've opened a bottle of wine recently, you'll know the importance of cork. But the eco-friendly and renewable material is getting a timely reappraisal by the industrial design industry too. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Architecture firm Squire's offices in King's Cross were getting a little tight at the seams when the team decided to look for new, bigger digs. To find it, they ventured south of the Thames to Brixton, where they uncovered a former department store space that, despite being almost abandoned for years, had potential. The Edwardian building was a beaut, but it kept its virtues hidden, buried underneath layers of plaster, graffiti and grime. Revamping it may have seemed like a daunting task at first, but it proved to be a worthwhile one, stripping back the layers that gave the building a new lease of life. The office that Squire created for themselves is a masterclass on how to redevelop a structure sensitively, and of course a calling card for clients who want to see its work and worldview. Monocle's Chiara Rimella took to the streets of South London to find out more.
It was completely a mess and it hadn't been looked after for many years. Most of the building was unoccupied. There were a series of false shop fronts on the front, which basically blocked it off from public view. Even the post office, which was the only remaining occupier, they had sort of grills on the windows. You couldn't see in or out of there. It was quite a sort of notorious place to have to queue and spend time. And even once you got inside the building, there were raised floors and lowered ceilings, so you couldn't really get a sense of the actual kind of building fabric. It's a former department store, an Edwardian annex to the Bon Marché, which was the first department store in the UK when Brixton in the early 1900s was a really fancy kind of retail and culture destination. And I think we wanted to expose the remnants of that heyday, as well as the decay and the misuse. And as you say, you can see remnants of the kind of the squatter days and the party days. So there's street art and graffiti in here, as well as, you know, decorative elements like mouldings and beautiful cast iron columns. We've got original 111-year-old Burmese teak and mahogany floors. The staircase as well is absolutely beautiful. It's got wrought metalwork, stained glass windows, patterned tiles, all original.
I wonder how many people walk in through the doors of the department store thinking it actually is a department store, and how many people are allowed to just come in and have a wonder. How do you open up this space?
We don't lock our door. Anyone is welcome to walk in. Some of them think it is a department store, some would like to shop here. And we always welcome them in and we always explain who we are and what we're doing. We're not able to let people access the workspaces unless it's a kind of prior arranged event.
How much of a leap of faith was it in the beginning?
I think we felt a responsibility as well. This is a Brixton landmark, which, you know, had been sort of almost out of sight for so long, and bringing it back into the public eye was a definite responsibility. I think the approach we took was sensitive, so we're not playing around with the building too much. We hope that, you know, we're the sort of occupiers for now, but we hope in another 100 years we haven't taken anything away. The furniture inside this building all relate to the kind of time period from 1906 to the current day, so you'll see antique display cases, as well as 1950s furniture, more contemporary pieces, The design approach is very much based around display, concessions, the sort of changing nature and the process of craft and making, which, you know, it always has been. So it almost feels like you're walking around different parts of our organisation. We have not just architects here, we have a kind of in-house model shop, interior design, illustration teams, graphics department. And I think all of those are kind of expressed slightly differently around the space. We're in a kind of project area at the moment where the architects, although everyone has an individual desk, the generosity of space we get by being in Brixton rather than Shoreditch or Islington means that everyone can have not only their own desk but a kind of breakout making space as well in their own area but also across the office floor. All of the desks were made bespoke for us by a South London joinery company called Opus Magnum, and again they provide areas for personalisation and display. So, you know, we've now got people bringing plants or curiosities from home. All of the office floors have openable windows, outside terraces wherever possible. And the idea is that if you were to come back to this area in a year, it would look different because maybe the project has changed or the project has evolved through the design process a bit further.
How much of this project do you think speaks of your architectural attitude as a practice?
We had experience, but this building, every building is different and every building requires a different approach. I think what this building allowed us to do is be much more bold in our approach. Obviously, when you're working for perhaps a developer who's looking to tenant a building, there's a certain sort of safety net that they want to know that that's the look that someone is going for. We could be much more bold and brave about how much we wanted to reveal and expose in this building. The additions that we make, we didn't want to spoil what was here. We wanted to kind of leave that story told.
Monocle's Chiara Rumella there, exploring architecture firm Squire's stately new HQ in London's Brixton. Now, as an aside, the story of London's grand department stores is a long one that's thankfully still being written. And while names such as Fortnum & Mason continue to reign in the city centre, perhaps no shop rode the wave of urban change more than the now-defunct Swan & Edgar department store. George Swan and William Edgar opened the space at No. 20 Piccadilly back in 1812, before the construction of Piccadilly Circus a few years later prompted them to make a small move to close by Regent Street. The area quickly grew into one of the world's most iconic junctions, and by the mid-19th century, the Swan and Edgar department store was a central figure in the famous postcard image, with their flagship premises taking up an entire street corner. Sadly, in 1917, the structure was badly damaged by a Zeppelin raid, and the reconstruction costs, among other woes, meant that the company was sold to competitor Harrods, which still stands on nearby Knightsbridge. The Swan and Edgar building still stands today, having been repurposed as the UK flagship for Tower Records, as well as the Virgin Megastore under Richard Branson. Today, it's home to a fashion retailer. It remains a beautiful and sought-after space in London's Piccadilly Circus. Perhaps more obliquely, however, it shows that buildings can have many lives and tell better stories the longer they're creatively reused. The metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries, suggestions and belligerent correspondence. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Rylan. He's at br@monocle.com. This remains Section D. Please do stay tuned. Now, of all the ingredients that go into crafting a memorable retail experience, it's also key to consider how to get punters inside and to show off your ethos, tout your tender to the passing and potential patrons. But the art of gold-leafed or judiciously drawn shop signs has wavered in the face of international brands and glass and steel shop fronts. In Vienna, at least, though, crafty calligraphers still rightfully take pride in their artistic shop signs, or Landenschilder, many of which still dot the cobbled streets of the Innerestadt, or historic First District. Though many signs have been lost to developers or poor renovation, there's a growing movement in the Austrian capital both to preserve and to renew the art form, for historic reasons, but also for the beauty of the city and to help shops tempting customers. As Monocle's Alexei Korolev reports, they've even got a festival dedicated to the art of shop signage.
I am at Vienna's Schikaneder Cinema, where something rather unusual is taking place. An award ceremony for best shop fronts.
Well,
The two winners are a laundry that has preserved its original sign for more than 40 years and a newly opened French bistro whose facade combines neon with hand painting. The ceremony is part of the Vienna Sign Week, a festival celebrating the city's typography and signage. It was organized by two signage enthusiasts, Tom Koch and Achim Gauger. Tom recently published a book called Ghost Letters Vienna about the city's disappearing old shop fronts.
Well, on one hand, there's the aspect of what we've lost and try to gain awareness of the tradition and heritage we've got. But I think another important thing is to strengthen those who keep the signs on, who have new shop fronts, that they try to make outstanding, regardless whether it's with a lot of money or hardly any money. But you can achieve quite surprising results, even with a small budget. So that's why we had this award together with the Wirtschaftskammer Vienna.
I guess it's hard work to organize something like this.
Oh, it definitely is hard work, as we are just two, as you can see. I found it very funny that I contacted various institutions in Vienna, if they could fund us in one way or the other. We got enormous great response. Everybody was saying, oh, that's great that somebody does something for this aspect of the Viennese cityscape, but we didn't get any funding at all. I found it very funny that the vice mayor of Vienna posted this Tuesday when we opened, don't we all love the old signs? And it's great, she posted it, but we couldn't get any funding.
Yes, my name is Achim Gauger. I'm a photographer from Vienna, and I'm running a project on Instagram since May 2012, and it's called Vienna City Typeface. And there I show at the moment 1,240 pictures of signs only from Vienna. The original idea was to motivate people to go through their towns and look what they can see in the streets, and so that they can tell what makes their city. What is it? Is it the buildings, or the signs, or the trees, or the people, or a combination of many things? And my focus very soon was on the signs, on the signage in Vienna. And 2 years ago, it began that we lost more and more of the signs. So the original idea to show people what we have now changed into a documentation of signs we are missing now in Vienna.
We recognize that these traditional shops are getting lost.
Martin Frey and Philipp Graf are running a project called Geschäfte mit Geschichte, Shops with History, in which they're documenting the erosion of small Viennese shops. They're releasing a book about their project as part of the Sign Week.
So maybe we start with the point where we meet, mm-hmm. because it's we are here on Wiener Hauptstraße. It's very interesting here because you can feel and see the transformation and loss of shops very immediately. In front here, it's called the shop, it's Goldene Kugel. Very big shop of household goods and hardware and tools. The shop owner died a few weeks ago, and it's very uncertain if the shop will continue or not. So if we can go a few steps further, we have to walk.
Yeah.
Here, the shop on the right hand, it's a very small shop. Now it's a gelateria.
Yeah.
But before, it was for 40 years a small boutique, Transalpine, specialized in books for railway. So it closed last year. Now in spring it opened a gelateria, and the next shop is a perfume shop. It exists already 40 years or 50 years and is there and will be there in the future. But the shop on the next was a little wine bar, mm-hmm. Winzerkönigin, which disappeared last year, and now it's refurbished and it's completely demolished there. And on the next to the Winzerkönigin was a small clockmaker, and it's also gone. Mm. And it's all in one building.
I don't think that we can change the political system and that we get more attention from the political system, but we need a change by the remaining stores, by the business people.
Let's go back now to Achim Gauger for some final thoughts.
We know that it's something like, I don't know, like this, so neons or this. It's expensive, of course, because we don't have 50 companies in Vienna who do this. We have only one or two, and it's a lot of handwork. So it's expensive, of course, but there are other ways to make good signage. And that, I think, is an important idea from the Sign Week, to put a focus on this,
yeah,
and to motivate the business people to have an open eye and open mind for this thing.
That was Monocle's Alexei Koryalov there, talking to the people, pointing the way to a more characterful retail future at Vienna Sign Week. Now, owl-eyed inhabitants of the UK capital may have clocked a flock of new commissions that celebrate sign-making techniques of yore, as many brands seek a closer relationship with both their customers and the areas in which they trade. A traditional sign can be a signifier of a shop's sensibilities while also being a beautiful thing to behold. It's a tradition that artist Ged Palmer greeted when he opened the Luminor Sign Company in Shoreditch, East London. The original firm Luminor took down its own sign in 1938, but the modern revival of the same name is a thoughtful tribute to the art of signwriting, and it does so by eschewing cookie-cutter fonts or vinyl transfers in favour of a good old handcrafted approach. This show's very producer Ben Ryland climbed the ladder himself for a crash course in sophisticated signage with Luminor's Ged Palmer.
In the 80s and 90s, in the 80s the vinyl cutter came along. Lots of sign men started hanging up their brushes and just switching to vinyl. And then also with the rise of desktop publishing and doing design digitally, then in the noughties, people started getting more and more interested in calligraphy and hand lettering. There was kind of this resurgence. And I think with that resurgence, people have been interested in like a lot of Victorian era graphics you see coming back in with that kind of like heritage look. My kind of personal era of what I'm interested in is like early modernist work. So a lot of deco and European. Just when you go around the cities of places like Paris and Barcelona, see all of their old signs. It's not so much that crazy, overly complicated stuff from the late 1800s and early 1900s, but more that like 20s, 30s, when it started kind of bringing in a bit of a cleaner aesthetic, but still had all the quirks and interesting weirdness going on. That's kind of my kind of where I'm at, I think.
I think you pick up on something quite interesting there, with especially when you're talking about roaming through cities and seeing how different signage relates to its place. Where do you see signwriting at the moment? I was in Paris recently, and I was on the metro. And when you travel from station to station, you can often see a very, very stark difference between how the stations are designed, but also specifically how the signage is designed as well. One station can be, it almost looks as though it's been locked away or something. No one's really touched it for decades and decades. And then the next one, you'll come along and it feels as though someone's just removed all of the ornamental pieces, yeah, that might have been here originally. It's just a blank concrete tube. Do you think sometimes we've kind of lost the art behind, especially public signage, in maybe this chase to make everything as clear as possible? Maybe we've made things a little bit unclear through their blandness.
As with many things, the devil's in the detail. Even like in London with the Johnston typeface, that was, I think, 1915 or like definitely in the 1910s. People probably wouldn't be struck by the fact that it's a beautiful piece of signage and typeface design. But again, it's that one of those early modernist sans serif typefaces that for anyone who's into lettering and type, I think everyone's kind of into it because it's just a classic. But with going to different cities, I mean, I think architecture and lettering and type really reflect the same things about times and places. And you talk about constructing a letter form, and in many ways, you know, deco lettering and nouveau lettering and those styles you see in Paris and other parts of Europe, they all fit with the same kind of flavour of that time. But I think the flavour of our time currently right now is a little bit, people tend to, it all looks a bit like Fisher Price to me sometimes. You know, like it's kind of so safe that it doesn't say anything.
Exactly.
You know, it's like slightly plasticky and just a bit.
Does it agitate you though, as a professional songwriter, to see something like that that is so bland, so basic, so, as you say, safe, almost to the point where it goes full circle? It tries to be so safe that it ends up being dangerous in its blandness. Do you look at that and think, there are so many basic, simple ways that could be improved?
I think everything goes in cycles. By things being a bit safe and clinical with modern graphic systems, that it is keeping people like myself in business, so that's not a bad thing. It's like the one I always use is basically I'm a massive nostalgia freak with the whole kind of world of design and graphics and typography. Like a classic one is back in the day, I used to have these amazing kind of thick printed airline tickets with great graphics on them. And now you have a smartphone with a QR code on it. And it's experientially like such a different thing. Or like luggage labels used to have on your old suitcases, like they are pieces of beautiful design. And so many of those little things that get lost in the transfer to a more digitally based way of life.
One can only imagine how the scene in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory might have played out differently had Charlie found a QR code and a smartphone hidden inside a chocolate bar.
Yeah, it doesn't really have the same kind of flavour to it. The aim with it is more and more people are aware of getting hand-painted signs, but I think if somebody seeks you out, it might be because they're already looking, but if it's presented to them on a high street, some people who maybe didn't even know that there was such a thing as hand-painted signs might say, hold on, I've got a cafe, why don't I do that rather than a vinyl that will peel off and look like crappy after a couple of years.
Ged Palmer there, the smart fellow behind the Luminor Sign Company in London's Shoreditch. He was speaking to Monocle's and this show's producer, Ben Rylan. Next, we head to Lisbon to examine how one of the nation's key exports may yet have unseen applications. Visitors to rural Portugal will be familiar with the sight of gnarled cork oaks, stripped below their canopies to provide stoppers for wine bottles. The firm Amarim, for one, makes over 4 billion of the 12 billion corks used annually and without felling a single solitary tree. But Cork's properties also see it used with clients as diverse as NASA and the cream of the industrial design crop. During the recent Portuguese Makers Craft Week, Saima Tarek met with the industrial designer Hugo Passos to find out why he thinks Cork's image, far from its nadir as naff 1970s furniture, remains untapped, as well as it being a versatile and eco-friendly resource for designers.
Every summer, the bark of the Quercus suba tree is meticulously harvested in the dense forests of rural Alentejo. Although it requires a lot of force, with workers wielding a hefty axe to make the cuts, the bark of this tree needs careful removal to not only protect them, but to also let it grow again for the next extraction. Over half the world's cork is produced here in this part of Portugal, mainly for wine and champagne stoppers. But this natural material is becoming an exciting resource for designers, architects and others who are coming to realise cork's seemingly endless potential. At the Portuguese Makers Craft Week in Cascais, after a presentation by leading cork company Amarim, designer Hugo Passos tells me why cork is just so cool.
I think there's been a lot of attention to it in the last, at least, 5 years. It's an ongoing go-to material because I think once people realize the properties and the qualities, it is quite unique. It's naturally antibacterial, which is fantastic. It's waterproof. It doesn't gather dust on the inside. It's extremely, it's almost got like what you call memory. So you can compress it and not really get distorted or, you know, you can, and then it's completely recyclable, reusable over and over again. It's just quite remarkable. And then you can mix it with all sorts of materials. We had the cement, we have, I don't even know, I mean, Amarim is going crazy about it, which is great. And then it can kind of mix these properties in a way with the properties of other materials, which is extremely interesting and kind of, you know, can almost get lost in it. And what are you going to do next? I mean, it would be nice to see porcelain and cork or ceramics and cork. That would be beautiful.
Cork is being used in everything from space shuttles to cruise terminals in the form of concrete mixed granulate, as well as providing the material and expertise for such pioneering ventures. Amarim's own foray into cork design has unleashed some contemporary products that are innovative as well as beautiful. Keiji Takeuchi's wine bottle stand flips the use of cork from mere stopper to display format. It's an elegantly inclined tabletop structure that holds and balances one full wine bottle at 90 degrees. Philippe Arakau's simple cork ice bucket makes use of its thermal insulation properties, while the floating toy boat created by design studio Big Game celebrates the playfulness and buoyancy of the material.
It is extremely versatile, and you can really kind of shape the look, if you want to call it that, of it really precisely. And in the machines that I've seen, you can control the grain, mix different grains, get a color in it, you can use it with rubber, and it's just, it's just something that comes from the outside of the tree that people, through the years, have used in a very, naive way, making the most beautiful of objects, like even beehives. It just shows that it's not just about processing a material industrially. It's even naturally, it's always been, I don't know why it hasn't been used more. It's been this kind of go-to material for people that probably had no education, and they come up with the most beautiful kind of use for it.
Ugo is currently experimenting with cork himself for a Danish design firm, after his 2014 cork door wedge became a bestseller. For this correspondent, the wedge is the epitome of good design. The door wedge compresses easily, doesn't attract dust, it feels lenient and makes no sound. All perfect attributes for its intended use. This is a far cry from many of the cork products now being made in Portugal, as a way to hype up the material, especially to sell to tourists. With everything from caps to trams taking on cork layers, Hugo believes that there is a danger of forgetting why cork is so important in the first place.
It feels a bit sad to see it become just a name, not being used to perform as it should. It's just like putting a sticker. So cork has become a little bit like a sticker marketing-wise, and everyone wants to make money from it, and it's fair enough. But then it's a bit silly to have certain things made out of cork, because it's, you're just forcing it. You just, or you're hiding it, because the actual thing is not made of cork. You just line it, as I said, or you just cover it in cork, glue it on, and it looks like cork, but cork isn't doing anything there. It's just, it could have been made out of wool, could have been made out of, I don't know. I think ethics is always an issue with making products, and just the reason why. Why are you making this? Is it because it's useful? Is it because there's nothing like that around and there's a need for it? Is it because you change the material and it becomes better? That was the reason for the cork wedge, because it's soft and you don't hurt your feet, etc. It's a typology that's been around forever. It's just changing the material, and okay, and then it's just cork, okay, but that's it. There's no big story around it, it's not. But I think, yeah, it's always an issue, I think, ethics, especially the way I approach, because I'm quite pragmatic or respectful for the past, because I think a lot of, so many beautiful things have been made before, and that somehow perform better than the new ones that are made now, puts you in check. And if you do have those references and that respect, and then you want to be at the same level if you can, or at least for the same reasons, and try to do it for the right reasons. That's the hard part.
Our very special thanks to Saima Tarek. Next week, we'll sit down with architect and designer Tim Campbell to discuss sensitive renovation and why he thinks it's okay for buildings to be beautiful again.
It was really about this soul-searching quest to try to understand why we are innately drawn to beauty.
Section D was produced by Ben Ryland and edited by Sarah Miles. My very special thanks to the man behind the glass, Kieran Banerjee. I'm Josh Fenner. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.